I cannot talk as much or as well about Jacksonville, Florida, as Gary could about Chula Vista. We are the homicide capital of Florida right now as we speak. We're also number one in several sexually transmitted diseases, and I can think of lots of other number ones that may not speak so well for where Jacksonville is in the Florida hierarchy. We're not as famous as Orlando. We don't have Disney. We're not a tourist destination like Miami or Tampa. We're just this little spot up in the northeast corner of Florida. And we got the Jacksonville Jaguars. We got an NFL team. Yay. That's about our claim to fame. But we are a good-sized city. We are one of the six major metropolitan areas in the state of Florida. And there it is. As you can see, it's a lovely facility. We built it right on the river, prime real estate property. And we did this before the real estate boom. So that kind of tells you where sometimes the thought processes of our particular community are. In 1991, we built this facility. We didn't want to do direct supervision, even though that was the cutting edge corrections process for the day, but that cost too much in personnel. So we built this modular design facility, which is, if you can remember the old Mad Max movies, the Thunderdome, that's kind of what the dorms look like. I'll show you that in a little while. And as you can see, our bed count, our capacity is 2,189, and it's currently, as of the day I made this slide, was 2,733. Now, you can address that by adding more bunks. One of the things we did when we first started this project was we have what was called boat beds. They're actually plastic portable bedding units, but PBUs were too hard to say, so we called them boat beds. And those were temporary beds that we sat inside the day rooms of the dorms for inmates to sleep in to help resolve some of the overcrowding. Eventually, we added a third bunk to the already double bunked cells. And that, again, we've got the capacity now of little bit over 3,000, so even now we're approaching that. So in 2006, we met with the Urban Institute, and I won't get back into what Nancy described as the whole backup of the research project. A lot of correctional facilities do not get involved in research because they don't see any end benefit to them. They see it as additional work with, you know, you're not getting paid additionally from a grant. You're not really gaining anything from it, except you get a lot of hassle from people coming in, talking to your inmates, talking to your staff, and sometimes finding out things you really don't want to know. However, from my perspective, I can say that there are a great deal of benefits to that. Number one, you need somebody to come in and tell you the things that you really don't want to hear. You need that independent perspective to come in and help you improve your system. And that's one of the things, one of the benefits that we have got from this process. When we first started on this project, we found that there was not a lot, as I highly suspected, there wasn't a lot of sexual assault within our individual facility. There was some, but real legitimate assaults, inmate on inmate assaults, were very rare. However, I'm going to tell you a bad story. Right before we got started on the implementation part of this project in September of last year, we had a real sexual assault occur inside one of our cells. And this is a tragic story, but it just illustrates why it's important to follow up on these kind of things. A lot of times people think, they're inmates, they're in jail, they get what they'd observe. This was a young man. The victim was a young man. He was arrested for grand theft. So he's placed inside a felony cell, triple bunk cell, with two other felony defendants. They're all classified as pretrial. They're all nonviolent offenders. This young man was in jail for grand theft. He took a gold bracelet from his brother and went and pawned it and bought an iPod with it. Well, Dad said, I'm going to teach you a lesson. And he called the police and reported the theft of the bracelet. And the young man was arrested and he went to jail to teach him a lesson. Well, he got taught a lesson. He was sexually assaulted by one of his cellmates pretty brutally. He didn't tell anybody. The only way we found out about it was when the other cellmate, who did not participate in the rape, came forward on his way out of the system 3 days later and said, hey, you need to check on the kid in my cell because the other dude had his way with him. We went up, investigated, sure enough, found out that it happened. Now, it's a bad story. The kid was bonded out the next day. Family decided, I guess, he had learned his lesson at that point. But anything that we can do to prevent that sort of thing from happening in a facility, our facilities are supposed to be safe. They're also supposed to be humane. And yes, they're also supposed to be a place that's designed as punishment, but that's not the kind of punishment that it's designed for. So, based on that, I was really delighted that we had the opportunity to try to do something to prevent that kind of violence from occurring in our facility. Now, everybody up here has said something about the changes that have taken place during the research project. One thing you can say about people, doing research with people, with human subjects, nothing is ever static. Everything changes. During the course of this project, we've increased and we've upgraded our cameras. We've gone from an analog to a digital system. We've added recording of our recreation areas. We've started a jail intelligence unit where we track security threat groups and house high-profile defendants in a different manner. We've improved our mental health care. We've replaced items that are used as weapons with more difficult-to-modify models. We've gone to a much smaller razor, for example, that's a lot harder to be made into a shank. We've gone to one-piece mop buckets. Everything that you think of that can be made into a weapon, inmates can make it into a weapon. And something else, too, and this will come up a little bit later, but no matter how rugged it is, if it can be torn up, an inmate can do it, and an officer can do it better. Here's the way we used to keep data. It really wasn't quite this bad, but it was really, this was close to it. This was real close to it. When we started the project, we had a very flat data collection system. Our incident reporting system, we wrote reports for everything, but we collected very small bits, just the very essential pieces of data. The data that was required by law was all we kept. So it was really hard to pull some of the things that we needed to analyze out of that system. Well, now, this is just an example of just one of the reports that comes from our reporting system, and Sarah and Nancy haven't even got a chance to see some of the, because that's recently changed, but now we can get virtually every data element involved in incidents, I mean, just common everyday incidents, the finding of contraband, inmate fights, of course, sexual assaults and all of the major things, but anything that we have to write an incident on now, we're able to, it goes into our data warehouse, we're able to slice it and dice it any way you can think of. Plus, that all rolls into our intelligence unit as well, and we were really able to do some really neat tracking of problems throughout the system that way. One of the things that we found as recommendations from the Urban Institute's review of the surveys that they did was that we did need to revise our classification system to a more behavioral-based process. We needed to implement more staff rounds tracking, and that's the piece that we finally decided to focus on. Because what we found was what constitutes a round was different in the eyes of some correctional officers as opposed to the eyes of the correctional administration. When we would say make a round, we meant, you know, get up, walk, you know, out of the pod, down into the cell, walk around the cell, look around, make sure that everybody's okay, and walk back out. What they said, we did a round. It was a visual round. Looks good. You know, and that was how a lot of cases, then they would type it in the system, did my round. And we found that there was a disconnect. And it wasn't just the fact that they weren't doing their rounds, it was that some were doing more rounds than others. And if you think about it, how that creates a conflict between officers, between staff at the line level, because some people are doing more work than other people. Some people are getting away with doing less work or what's perceived to be less work. So we decided if we implemented the rounds tracking devices, we would level that particular playing field, and we would also get some good quantifiable data about how often the officers are down in the dorms and interacting with inmates. This is a view from inside the dorm. You're on the upper level of the dorm looking down. That big area there is the day room. These dorms, this particular one, would originally have been a 48-person dorm, but now that we've triple-bunked it, it's a 64-person dorm. And that's how large each one of the dorms are in the facility, and there's six floors in the facility. Now, here's where the officers work. This is inside the pod looking out. As you can see, now it's a little bit glarier than it actually is because when we're actually in there, we turn the lights down, and you can see into the dorms better with those lights down. You don't have so much glare. But still, there's four of those large dorms around each pod. So you can imagine there's ample opportunities for inmates to get away with stuff. You've got one, maybe two security officers who are making rounds inside the dorms, and then you've got one officer up here in the pod who essentially are watching the officers making the rounds. And you've got now probably an average of 300 to 400 inmates on each one of these pods. And you can see that it's not easy to keep up with what's going on. We talked already about the reasons why we went to the rounds tracking system. And we looked into a lot of different products. I would have loved to have had the full service RFID, which is where it would just essentially track the officer everywhere they went. But you're talking upwards of $1 million to install a wireless system and an RFID system in a large aging facility that we're likely going to move out of within the next decade. And I couldn't convince the budget powers to be that that was something that we needed to go with. However, we were able to get the budget model, which is the pipe, which essentially is just a series of those buttons, and you just have to go, as an officer, you go, and you have to be within the proximity of that button to record your round, and then those rounds are then downloaded later on. It's not a real-time system, which I was disappointed in that. I wanted something that would give us that data right away, but now they go and they download it at the end of their shift, and we're able to see what kind of rounds they're making. So we're still in the process of refining our reports, and the good thing is we've had a couple of issues that have come up right away. This we've been able to determine things didn't happen because we were able to prove officers were in the proximity when things were alleged to have been occurring inside of dorms. So that's been one positive out of it. We've been able to eliminate some manual data entry, some typing in of rounds and things like that on the computer, because now they're collecting that with the pipe system. The anecdotal information from the inmates has been really very positive. And again, this is just the inmates telling us things, but they say that they do have more access to the officers. They say that there is less commissary theft. One of the other recommendations was for us to try to get a place that the inmates could lock up their personal belongings, and we're still trying to come up with a solution for that. Whatever solution that we seem to come up with that we think that we may be able to work out, where we've not been able to get funding to do. So we're still trying to look for a budget solution to that as well. But in the meantime, the inmates are telling us that the officers making the increased rounds are holding down the commissary theft. And again, like I said, some of our personnel have said, hey, I like it because Joe over here, who won't ever do nothing, he's having to do the same amount of work that I'm having to do now. Now, the challenges is, they told us when we got this pipe system, oh, they can't tear them up. They're in correctional facilities all over the United States. We don't have any problems. They're extremely rugged. Well, we have put their ruggedness to the test. And in fact, right now they're talking to us about voiding our warranty on the products because we have had so many of them that we've had to have replaced. We're working through that with them. We've had some negative reaction from the corrections personnel, and I think maybe that's why some of them haven't been quite as rugged as advertised. I think we've had some officers who may have been overly enthusiastic in their use of the devices as far as, you know, they're hitting the button, so to speak. Oh, I thought you had to hit the button. No, you just have to get it in the proximity of the button. And we're also working through a process of how we are addressing when we pull those reports and we see rounds weren't made in a timely manner. What is our response as management? Is that something that we look at for retraining? Do we begin to take disciplinary action? Do we progress in that disciplinary action? And what we've done from this point is we've looked at the first instance that somebody is not making their rounds properly, and we address that with counseling or training, and then from that step on we will move with progressive discipline. Now, if there is a reason why they cannot make their rounds, there is an incident occurring, they are, you know, feeding up or they're doing something else, then they have a way of recording those things so that it's not a unforgiving system, so to speak. There are ways that can be done, but yet they are responsible for making those rounds, and they're just going to have to get them done. One of the other things, too, that made the project much more acceptable in the officers' eyes is throughout this research, we included them in on the decision-making process. We made sure that we had the personnel that would actually be using those devices in on the research. We had them in on the testing of the product, and we also had them in on the writing of the policy and the procedure and the eventual response to, you know, misproduced rounds. We had them come in and be completely involved in that. And that was a big help, because I think when you make a systemic change like this, if you do not have that buy-in from the line level personnel, it is very easy for them to sabotage a project or prevent it from working as well as it could have. So hopefully what we're going to do in the future is we are going to analyze the incident data. We're hoping that it will show a reduction in violence, in self-harm attempts and things like that within our system. We do want to continue and add the inmate storage for personal property, and we do have plans as well, budget permitting, to expand our camera system as well into the inmate housing areas. We currently have a camera system that watches all of our processing areas and our releasing areas, which is where our highest propensity for violence occurs, staff versus inmate type of violence within the facility. Now we need to expand that into those areas where inmate versus inmate violence has the highest propensity to occur. So thank you, and you guys come see us.
Thank you very much.